You know, these tabloids, you know them, maybe you love them, as wacky as they seem to be at times. You have to ask, where do they get these stories? How can they print them with a straight face? How do they get away with it? And are they that much different from the so-called mainstream media? I'm not so sure anymore. If you've ever wondered about the inner workings of the tabloids, put on a pot of coffee and get ready to wade right into the swamp with my guest, Paul Bannister, a veteran of the industry and author of a fascinating new book called Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. There is a passage in the new book, Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death, that sort of sets the tone for what else is included in the book. And it goes like this. Because of it, I strapped into a series of tourist class chairs in the air and traveled the world reporting for supermarket tabloids whose editors sent me to be groomed by a gorilla, to work with the CIA's psychic spies, and to talk to ghosts. The baffling chair, which was supposed to cause swift death to all who sat in it, led to an exercise guru in sparkly underpants prancing on my desk, exposed me to the wrath of movie stars and presidents, dumped me into a hurricane, and made me suffer the mysterious revenge of a Brazilian witch doctor. And I'd only looked at the fatal furniture. Thank goodness I never sat in the thing. I'll tell you, this book, Paul Bannister, this is a wonderful book. I finished it today. It's so well written, so clever, made me laugh out loud, and made me think a lot about my profession. I really thank you for being here with us tonight.
Well, George, you read that beautifully. I think we might have a spot for you at the royal wedding. How you fix at the end of the month?
I'll open up the calendar for that. Yeah, that'd be great.
Well,
tell me this.
I'm glad to be talking to you anyway, George.
I'm really glad you're here and looking forward to this. Let's start a little bit about you. You were a mainstream journalist, and I use that in air quotation marks. You reported on city council meetings and things of that sort, right?
Bigger stories than that, even. I worked for the national newspapers in Britain. I even worked briefly for the BBC. The Enquirer headhunted me, and I thought, well, a couple of years in Florida would be very nice, you know. And I did some pretty big stories with them, too. For instance, I was the first American-based newsman to get to the world's worst air crash, you know, in Tenerife. We did all kinds of other stories, actually, over the couple of decades of it. I became actually senior reporter there, and I specialized in parapsychology.
We'll get into some of the specifics about what you covered. First, sort of the journalism background. I mean, Americans, people on this side of the pond, they look at British newspapers, and I think they probably think of all of them as sort of tabloids because of just the crazy and ultra-competitive nature of journalism over there. Do you understand that?
Yes and no. First of all, you've got a large population in a small place. There's 65 million people in a place the size of California. When I was working there were 11 morning papers in every city, national papers, you see, because it's easy to distribute them. Now, what that meant, of course, was on any major story, there'd be a pack of people working to get it. And people used whatever means they could to outfox their rivals, you know, on the other papers. When the Enquirer moved from New York, the Enquirer started in New York as a horror paper, basically, you know, reporting traffic accidents and, you know, bloody photographs, and was selling about 1 million. And the publisher, who was the godson of Frank Costello, the mafioso, the publisher moved it all down to Florida, and he decided he wanted very competitive journalists on the paper. And so he recruited about 70 or 80 Brits. There were some Americans among us, actually, some of my good friends there were, you know, from the mainstream U.S. press. But by and large, the mainstream media here looked down on the tabloids as being, you know, beneath them. But what the tabloids did that the mainstream American media didn't do was they were not afraid to pull a checkbook out and buy up a source and say, okay, here's the money. You talk only to us until, you know, we've had the things published first.
So you had not, had you written stories that came to their attention that were sort of paranormal or weird, and they figured you're the kind of guy who could write for us, or they just liked your aggressiveness?
They actually didn't want to employ me. I'd done a few when I was working on the Daily Mail in Britain, which is still a very large and fine newspaper there. I'd done some freelancing for the Enquirer. A friend of mine who was working at the Enquirer, you know, told me about it, and I came up with a number of stories, and one of them made the you know, front page lead in the Enquirer of the day. And it was a story about the baffling chair of death. We'll more on that later. But the Enquirer editor came recruiting to Britain, and I went to see him, and he said, no, we don't want to recruit a married guy because we had one once, and his wife used to object when he went out of town. So I said, well, hey, I did that story there. You know, you've got a copy of the paper in front of you. I did that front page lead. And he could hardly say to me, no, you can't come for a tryout. So I squeezed in under the wire, as it were.
As you describe in the book, there are a lot of your colleagues who were from the British Isles, Irish and Scotch, and folks who came over to give it a go as well, who thought of themselves as, well, I might as well go to Florida and stay for a couple of months of vacation on somebody else's dime.
Absolutely true, absolutely true. They come with no intention of staying. But, you know, a month in Florida traveling, you know, at the Enquirer's expense. And they had pretty lavish expenses. We didn't get to make any money off them, but we could stay wherever we wanted and eat and drink whatever we wanted. And if we wanted to, you know, hire a helicopter, then we damn well did. They didn't care what we spent because the paper was making a ton of money.
Was there shame in making that transition from the paper's mainstream, and again, in quotation marks, to tabloid?
I did some major stories for the Enquirer. I mean, I really did. I didn't do too many celeb stories, especially in the early days. I was doing things like, you know, the CIA and their remote viewing. I worked for 3 months with an astronaut, with Edgar Mitchell, you know, the sixth man to walk on the moon, the guy who drove the lunar lander. We went around the country together. He was introducing me to some of his contacts. I did all kinds of big stories for the paper that were valid. There's no question about that.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of those stories I've covered myself. I know Edgar Mitchell and I've interviewed him and Hal Puthoff and those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Puthoff and Targ, where I was very close to them. I did a whole series. In fact, I actually broke their major stories in the popular press. These are guys who were working for the CIA. On a 9-year contract, a $1.1 million a year contract that actually got extended. The DARPA, as you know them, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, took over. And that thing, that line of investigation to train psychic spies, lasted for 20 years and $25 million. The DOD is probably still doing it. But of course, it mysteriously just stopped and all went away in 1995, officially.
We'll get into some of the big stories and details about them. I think I want to talk about more about the mechanism of how it works at these tabloids, because the question I was asking, whether there was any trepidation or shame involved in making the switch. I know you got to work on some big stories, but you also know that it's a much different environment going there to work for a tabloid.
And the beast today is a different one. You know, the tabloids today are celebrity fan rags. You know, they're really not very good. But to come back to your point, yeah, a guy who worked there, Ray Smith, a friend of mine, is Canadian. And one of his Canadian pals was going home to Toronto for the weekend or something. And Ray said, if you see my mom, he says, don't tell her I'm on the National Enquirer. She thinks I'm playing piano in a whorehouse. so it might give you an idea. You know, it was not something that, although in the mid 70s, before the tabloids started to go celebrity, I mean, I was welcomed into, you know, as I say, DARPA. I was welcomed right into their headquarters. I've been into the Langley. I've been into the CIA building for the Enquirer. It wasn't shameful at first. And then when they started going after the celebrities and the celebrities fought back, there's a whole history behind that. The celebrities wanted their secrecy. They wanted their – you talk about secrecy, you know, secrets in government and UFO research. Well, celebs are the same. When the studio system collapsed and the celebs are no longer making 5 or 6 movies a year, you know, a small cadre of them, when a celeb got a chance at one $10 million movie, and that would probably be his career, they suddenly decided they couldn't have these cozy relationships with the press anymore, where they were being, you know, it was hand, they were hand in hand. That was really the way of it. And the publisher of the Inquirer decided that nice isn't news. And he wanted celebrity stories that showed them for what they were. And then the celebs brought in their own watchdogs and shut down, you know, they closed the gates. So the tabs were left with no real choice but to
dig through their garbage cans.
Dig, yeah, indeed, they did just that. Because the thing is that if they're not going to cooperate, you've got to get the story somehow if you want to sell magazines. And that was the bottom line. I mean, that's the bottom line, whether it's the New York Times or the Financial Times or the Globe. They just want to sell a magazine.
Talk to me for a couple of minutes on how it worked, because that's what people want to know, I think, mm-hmm. is do you just make this stuff up out of thin air? Do you sit around and brainstorm and let's make a story about the incredible wrestling cheese and have a good laugh about it? Or how does it work?
The wrestling cheese, that he used to lose all his doubts, you know, because that was the problem. They did it by rhymes. No, nowadays the tabs basically decide on a headline, and then they go and backfill from there. They'll say, well, let's. For instance, I had a briefing from Globe, and they said, we want you to go out to Honolulu and find out Obama's mother's secret sex diary. Okay, I can just see that, you know, Obama's really going to want to tell me about this one. So anyway, I went out to Honolulu and I spent a couple of weeks there digging around, and I didn't find a diary. But I did find that I was 10 months too late. His cleanup team had been in, and their friends had been shushed and their enemies had been silenced somehow.
Well, let's stay on this for a second. You think Obama had a cleanup team that basically told everybody, don't tell the story about smoking weed or chasing around
whatever? He told that story himself. That was innocent enough when he was a teenager. But whatever he did was shut down. I mean, it's standard operating practice. If you're running for president, that's what you do. Somebody goes in and cleans up before people pull embarrassing, skeletons out of the cupboard.
Basically, though, your editors start with a headline. They send you out to find a way to justify that headline, and you basically cannot diverge from the assignment. That's how you describe it in the book.
That's actually quite, that's pretty close to the truth. Especially under the old publisher, he approved an idea, and that's what you got. You might come up with a better story, you know.
But you don't write the actual story.
We wrote a file. It would be a 2,000-word file. I wouldn't say that this fellow is a doctor, and, you know, because I've been sitting in his surgery, I have to say where he did his internship, what training he had, what kind of a doctor he was, and have it so backed up so the attorneys would take a look at that file. Somebody would run a précis off. They'd give it to a rewrite guy. He'd write it down to 250 words, and then the attorneys would go through it and make sure. And they actually had a research department in those days that would literally check off with a dot over every word what the final write said and make sure any quotes were absolutely right there on tape. So, of course, we found ways around it.
Well, I found that absolutely astounding and amazing and amusing is that you had people checking the facts, but then you would find a way to manufacture facts or quotes or find someone who would say what you needed said.
The freelancers would do that, of course, not the staff guys. The freelancers wanted to make the money, and there was good money there. But what some of the freelancers would do is they'd write the story, and then, you know, the editor would get it and say, well, you know, we need this on tape. I said, that's fine, I'm going to do a read back. And they'd call somebody and say, are you George Knapp? And the guy say, yes. Well, George, let me read the story back to you. Is this what you said? And they'd read the whole thing back on tape, and you'd say, yes, that's right. Only it wasn't George Knapp, it was one of their friends. So he got to the stage where, you know, there was one couple in L.A. made $300,000 in just over 18 months on these fake stories they put together and got right through this elaborate research department, not to mention the attorneys. And finally they got found out, of course. A particular celebrity, got fed up with all these stories about him. And he employed a private eye who romanced one of the girls in the accounts department, and she provided him with evidence of where the checks were going. And it went from there.
Tell me this. Has there ever been a story that you worked on that you basically wrote, then handed it to the editors, and by the time it gets out, it has no relationship whatsoever to the truth? It's just basically incredibly misleading And examples
not none, not none, but sometimes they would take things and they would stretch it and stretch it. And you say, wait, you know, you can't really do that. That's no, we need this. You know, shut up and, you know, and let's get this done. Fortunately, as I say, I was doing some celeb stuff, but fortunately, the area I was working in, you know, with parapsychology and so on, I didn't need to do that. The stories were juicy enough anyway.
Let's talk about the baffling chair of death. The title, it's in the title of the book. So tell me that story. Because I think it gives a good...
I don't want to tell you the end of the story, though, George.
That's, understood.
The deal was, I heard about it. It was a chair in a pub in a little town called Thirsk in Yorkshire. And the story was that anybody who sat in it would die suddenly and usually within 3 days. So I went out there, and here was this chair, and it was actually that the landlord, Tony Earnshaw, had it in an outhouse, not an outhouse as we know it, but in an old stable at the back of the pub, under a big pile of wooden beer crates. And I said, well, you know, it's an old antique chair. You know, what's the story? He said, too dangerous. Can't have it, you know. And he gave me the story of how three or four of his friends or people he knew had, you know, sat in it, and one left the pub and drove into a tree. Another one went back to work and fell off a roof. He was a contractor. Somebody else had a heart attack in the marketplace in Ripon, you know. So I thought, well, this is all right, you know. So I wrote the story, filed it to Florida, and they came back and said, no, we want dozens of victims. This chair's hundreds of years old. So I went back, and I had to find some more victims, of course. And every, you know, they it was all there, but didn't quite ring right somewhere. The local vicar, you know, nice man, Mr. Mannering, his name was, he said, that chair is absolutely evil. If I had my way, I'd burn it. I'd just pour petrol over it and burn it, you know. But anyway, I dug around a bit, and it turned out that the pub was right alongside what had been a World War II airfield, airstrip, and Canadian squadrons actually were flying out of there, and they'd had, I've forgotten the numbers now, but they'd had something like 20% casualties. So, you know, 20 of every 100 men who'd gone flown out of there hadn't come back. And this pub was the closest thing to the airstrip. And, you know, you had to assume that some of them had been sitting in it, you know, on a dare or whatever, young guys. And so I figured that was probably the origin of the legend. The pub, by the way, if anybody's interested in going, is called the Busby Stoop. The man whose chair it was allegedly cursed it was Thomas Busby, and he'd murdered his father-in-law back in 1702, and I remember I was only a young reporter in those days, and he'd been hanged outside the pub and left in chains. His body was left in chains. The story was that he'd cursed the chair before he was taken out and hanged.
But basically, to get the numbers up to where it was really, truly a chair of death, you had to basically blame the deaths of any airmen who flew over the chair on the chair.
People who sat in it. And I went around the graveyard and interviewed a few people. Well, you know, those people come up with good quotes, you know.
And how many people did you come up with as victims of the chair?
It was probably a couple of dozen by the time we finished.
And this story stayed with you for a long time, though.
The chair is still there, actually. If anybody, any of your listeners are touring, it's in a museum in Thirsk, and it's hanging on the wall with a chain across it so you can't sit in it. I talked to the curator earlier this year when I was just tidying the book up, you know, and he said, we've had six or seven Japanese TV crews come in here, and they want to take it off the wall. And I won't let them. It's too dangerous.
So were they going to let you sit in it?
I didn't want to sit in the dump. I had to make a TV ad for a book I wrote way back, and the chair was in that. And the commercial guys, you know, I go out to Palm Springs to make the thing, and they've got this chair sitting there. They go, okay, sit in it and read. I don't know, sit in that. It's okay. We got it from a props house. It's okay. It's not the real one.
We're talking with Paul Bannister, author of the new book, Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death. Many more stories to come. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. And this is Carly Simon telling you what could be a tabloid story of her own. You're So Vain. Who's she talking about? My guest tonight, Paul Bannister, who is also a writer, author of the new book Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death, an insider's look at the tabloid industry and how it's evolved over the years, the money involved, the targets that they chased, celebrities and politicians and UFOs. As I mentioned early in the program, for a while, the National Enquirer did some really good work on UFO stories, broke some fairly big stories, including the report on the 1975 overflights, UFOs flying over ICBM bases on the U.S. and Canadian border, a story that only later was picked up by mainstream media. We're going to get into a behind-the-scenes look at how the papers operated, the money they paid, and whether or not there was a connection between the publisher of the National Enquirer and the CIA. Stay with us for more of our interview with Paul Bannister here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM. My guest is Paul Bannister, author of Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death. Paul, is it fair to say that there isn't much of a difference, or at least the difference has been somewhat obliterated between tabloids and more mainstream media these days? I mean, you look at network newscasts covering Lindsay Lohan's latest arrest or who Madonna is sleeping with, and I don't know where the networks end and the tabloids begin.
You're very, very astute. That's absolutely right. The mainstream media is very quick to point the finger at the tabloids themselves and at the fan magazines, because there is a whole cadre of these magazines. You know, you've seen them out there, Us and People and so on, and that's all they are. They're fanzines. But the mainstream media is following celebrities like a cat after catnip. You know, it's got to the stage actually where readers are expecting to be deceived by the media. People just don't believe it. You referred earlier to the sort of decline of prestige of journalists. You know, we're down there now with used car salesmen and so on. Thank God I'm an author, not a journalist, hey, George? but it's true. The mass media is so much in a corner now financially that they're doing anything to get readership. They're scrambling to survive, and if it means going to the lowest common denominator, then that's what they'll do.
I mean, you know, there's no question that transition, that line has been crossed, and a lot of it has to do with what the audience wants to see. I mean, that's just it, the bottom line.
If you're out there buying the Economist will thrive. If you're not, then it's going to go under. You know, it's as easy as that. You get the press you deserve. If you don't want to buy the decent stuff, or if you don't discriminate between the outrageous, one or two of the tabs, for instance, we all remember the Weekly World News. I mean, this is the one that sort of got all the headlines. This is the one with, you know, aliens dating Hillary Clinton and all the rest of it. People knew when they got that they were being deceived. They knew it was entertainment, and the thing sold a million a week, mostly to college students, because they had some ingenious storyline. One of my friends walked into the Wacky's office, and his pal, a nice Scotsman, Bill Burt, was sitting there. And after the Enquirer office, the Weekly's office, and was deathly quiet. And he said, "Bill, why so quiet?" He said, "Well," he said, "we have all these experts in the building." He said, "we don't need to go bothering people with telephone calls."
Tell me this about, I remember the alien. It seemed like every couple of weeks there'd be a new, and I have to admit, I collected some of them just because they were hilarious. They were hilarious. The alien would be meeting at the White House, then he's dating Hillary, then maybe they had a baby together. And
he got around. Socialite alien.
I had to believe, though, that there had to be some sales figures to back it up, that maybe the sales spiked every time you had the alien on the cover.
Well, I'm not an expert on that particular publication. I only ever did one story for them, and it was a really good story, though. Here's the tale, George. We can tell the truth here. I wrote about how the Saudis had a shortage of fresh water, so they went up to the Arctic and they captured an iceberg, and they towed it down across the Atlantic, and they just barely got the thing through the Straits of Gibraltar and across the Med, and they somehow got the thing ashore, you know, in Saudi Arabia, and when it melted inside, were the remains of an alien space expedition frozen in the ice. So they called on the Americans, of course, to come and open this up, and they opened the craft up, and an intrepid investigator went in, and it was blank inside except for one small little crystal altar with a picture of George Knapp on it.
Okay, so tell me about how that story works. You start with the premise, hey, somebody realizes, you know, there has been discussion about hauling icebergs to places in the world, and then who makes up the part about the spacecraft?
Well, that was the thing. You see, you've got to put a spin on it. So that's how the Weekly World News and works. And in fact, it's not too far off the principle that most of the tabs do work to now. They'll see something in the New York Post, a celebrity story. What have we got recently? We've got Nicolas Cage arrested drunk in New Orleans, right?
Right.
Allegedly drunk, I'm sorry. So they'll say, well, okay, let's see now. Why would he have been drunk? Well, perhaps, he was had a terrible row with his wife. He was confused, if I remember the story, he was confused about whether he owned the house they were standing outside.
Right, arguing with his wife out in the street.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So maybe, he's a secret. He owns half of New Orleans. So they'll run this story, they'll spin the story off from those little kernels of truth. And they'll spin the story off that he secretly owns half the French Quarter.
Let's talk about the Enquirer for a moment, unless you want to go on
okay.
with...
No, that's fine.
You know, when you were, you mentioned, and I want to get into the whole story about the publisher, because it's relevant to where we'll be heading in this. But you said when it started, when it was in New York, he would concentrate on the grisly stories, such as, mm-hmm. I used my dead baby's face for an ashtray.
Mm-hmm. And then
it changes after the move to Florida to a Hey Martha kind of a story, right?
Yeah, well, the thing was, you see, Gene Pope was a very astute businessman and very focused, and he was a sort of, I wanted to say benevolent dictator, but he wasn't a benevolent one. He was a dictator. He knew exactly, he was an autocrat. He owned the whole damned Enquirer. It was all his. So he didn't have to consult anybody on what he wanted to do with it, and what he wanted to do was sell copies. So when he first got the paper, it was just a paper in New York, and he was given a small loan, various numbers, 75,000 is the most popular, and he bought it, and he saw that crowds of people would gather around the site of a traffic accident to, view the gore. So he started putting those photographs in. But when he took it from, he decided to grow the paper into a national one, not just be the New York Enquirer, he took it to Florida. And he had the brilliant idea of putting it into the supermarkets, put it right there at the checkout where you just tuck it into your basket. It was 35 cents or something in those days. And the supermarket said, we don't want corpses hanging around, in the meat department. We really don't need that sort of stuff. We don't want blood and gore. So he turned it around and he said, right, well, and in its heyday, the Enquirer is running something like 70 or 80 stories a week. And there were category stories. There'd be celebrity, occult, how-tos, how to be more creative, how to be a better listener, how to choose a pet, things like how to stretch a grocery dollar, medical breakthroughs, arthritis was a huge seller, UFOs were a huge seller. And then they had standard things, this reveals your personality. They did some good work with government waste stories, the $200 hammer, things like this. Reader polls. So they had all these categories of stories. And people would go to the checkout. Celebrity was part of it. They'd be looking at a picture of Elvis or somebody. But they could also say, and I had people say to me, I always buy it for the diet stories. Others say, well, there's the shopping tips. I like that kind of stuff.
I buy Playboy for the men's fashion articles.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, they do a very nice line in socks. But people actually got some value out of the magazine. It was a good read. It really was a good read. And for a while, the Enquirer was pretty accurate, especially with medical stories. We actually would submit stories on, to the American Heart Association. Arthritis stories went through a panel of doctors and all this. But gradually what happened, of course, as the celebrity influence on the paper got more and more, and Hollywood hated the paper because we were digging up dirt on them, and the paper got, its reputation was more and more tainted, And then the doctors were backing away, and the reputable ones said, I don't have my name in it. Happened to me, you know. I mean, I had stories for a year or so with people, and then they said, well, you know, I can't be in there anymore. In fact, there was a guy that you will know, I'm trying to remember his name, is at the University of Wyoming. He was a ufologist up there.
Leo Sprinkle?
Leo, that's exactly right. I didn't do UFO stories. That was Bob Pratt's area. I'm sure you knew Bob in those days.
Yeah, he was a great reporter, too.
He was a fine reporter. And you don't underestimate the quality of the reporters, you know, because the Weekly World News carries strange stories. But the, you know, Inquirer reporters did the job, and they were doing it accurately. But what happened, gone to celebrity, and increasingly you can't get the stories. You can't go to the front door. I was invited to the showing of a new movie in San Francisco. I went along, did the press gig thing, you know, stayed overnight in the hotel, had my time slot to go and interview the star of this not very good movie, as it happened. And when she heard that, I wasn't even doing it for the Inquirer. I was doing it for a magazine in London. And when she heard that there was a tabloidy magazine from London there, she said, no, I don't care if we've invited him. Go. I'm not going to talk to him. I got kicked out, thrown out of my ear.
You know, I know there is a stigma, but you look at Piers Morgan. He's a tabloid guy, right? And now
he was the editor of the Daily Mirror. It couldn't be any more tabloid than that in Britain.
And now he is the sort of the headliner for CNN.
Do you think you've seen him? Do you think he's a stupid guy?
No, he's not a stupid guy.
You think he doesn't have any morals? No, not at all. But these are people who know how to make a story attractive to a lot of people.
I saw an interview. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Paul. I saw an interview that Piers Morgan did the other night with Jesse Ventura, which he was really sort of highfalutin, high and mighty. Well, how you believe in all this crazy conspiracy stuff, and kind of putting him down for it. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this guy came from a tabloid background. Surely he has worked and defended these kinds of stories himself.
I would expect so. I mean, but again, you see the Mirror, the British tabloids they're following the same rules that the American press is going. They're following celebrities. And so, you know, they'll do startling stories about celebrities, but they're, I'm pretty sure that Morgan isn't familiar with UFOs or conspiracy theories and so on. And so because he doesn't know about them, then he'll probably disparage them.
Talk to me about tabloids at their zenith, because I know that I forget what the number is, but it's millions of copies a week that we're selling of the National Enquirer. Big money involved.
The legendary issue was Elvis Presley's picture on the cover, his last picture, and that allegedly sold 7.2 million. But typically the papers were selling closing on 5 million a week just for the Enquirer, not the Star. Not Globe. Globe wasn't owned by that group then. Star wasn't owned by the same group. They're all owned, by the way, by one group right now. And between them, they probably sell a million. Between them all. Maybe I'll be generous. Maybe 1.5 million. But, I mean, they were selling 5 million, just the Enquirer. And the Star was probably trailing along at, you know, 3.5. And then Globe, and Midnight was going in those days, and Examiner, and the Weekly World News. The Weekly World News was selling 1 million. So when Gene Pope died, his widow sold the Inquirer, and a couple of a couple of the other magazines that got dragged along in its slipstream, you know, like the Weekly World News, because that was printed on the old Inquirer presses when it was no longer needed. They went to color. And she sold it for $420 million.
My gosh.
And the guys who bought it made some cuts, and they lived out of the inventory for a while. But they turned a $70 million profit in the first year. And Pope had been taking out something like $6.5 million for himself. That was it. And the rest he was plowing back into the paper.
Well, you make a point in the book about how much money they would spend on stories. And I guess you were paid pretty well compared to what you would have been making staying in Britain.
Oh, yeah.
How could you 20% more, 50% more?
About 200%.
Oh, Well, no wonder
We,
they
we
could attract.
our one of our rewrite girls. I'm talking. Oh, and this would be, let's say 75. That was probably about the, you know, that was probably the high tide mark of the paper. 75, 76, 77, something like that. Well, Whitney Presley died 77. So I'll say around then. One of our rewrite girls was making more than 100,000 a year at a time when, you know, a Time magazine journalist might be on 35.
What I was impressed by are the expenses, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, is that people would, they'd spend anything to get somebody to do a story.
It did not matter. If you had a receipt, you were reimbursed. It did not matter.
And I tell you, I was pretty envious about some of the places you went and places you stayed. And there's one story in particular you detail in the book about a guy who went in search of utopia, which is an assignment that I would like to get sometime.
John Harris spent, I think, 3.5 months. I'm doing this from memory now, but I think it's 3.5 months. He went all around the world. He could, there's a fairly detailed piece about this in Tabloid Man, by the way. Could I do a shameless plug here?
If
your listeners look at my website, which is bannisterbooks.com, they can get a sample of the book, and they'll know a little bit more about what we're talking about. But no, John went around. I went to about 40 countries for the paper. Here's a for instance. We got a story in, a rumor in, that in the middle of the Baja Peninsula, in the painted caves, there were pictures of ancient astronauts. So, the papers, I knew Eric von Daniken reasonably well, as it happened. I'd done stories with him in Europe. He lived in Switzerland, nice guy. So anyway, they said, get down there. So I rounded up a photographer, a good guy, got an archaeologist and an anthropologist from Santa Fe. We all met in San Diego. We rented a little twin-engine plane, flew down to, what was the name of the place, near Loreto. It's the Sierra San Francisco is where these painted caves are, the Cuevas Pintadas. We went down to this this little town down there. Got a couple of muleteers, three muleteers actually, and a handful of riding mules, seven riding mules for us, and a couple of burros to carry the gear. And then we had a couple of 3 weeks in the desert looking around. We actually found something very, very interesting. There were all these paintings. I'm sure people have seen these things, but they call them horn hat men. And do you remember the little thing that they sent out on the Gemini space probe, you know, the naked man and woman with a hand up in greeting?
Yes, yes.
And the star chart to show where they come from. Well, these horn hat men are painted on the cave walls. They've been there for 600 years or more. And they seem to be wearing a helmet. They've got the hand up in that greeting. And we found a thing painted on the wall, and I can't tell you anything except it looked like a bowler hat, if you like, with flames coming out of the bottom. It could easily have been a saucer, very easily. I don't know what it was. It didn't fit any of the other paintings. But these things we know were there 600 years ago because the missionaries described them when they arrived from Spain. So these people were drawing a painting on the cave walls. The caves are kind of big, shallow things. And they can be seen there now. You just go down and look, and it's right there.
I think that sounds like a wonderful assignment. I'm not sure about riding on a burro for 3 weeks in the desert. I much would have preferred the guy searching for utopia, because as you describe it in the book, he spent 3.5 or 4 months going to Bali and Tahiti and staying in great hotels. And, well,
everywhere.
And you would slowly cross them off the list. I guess this has a problem. It has too many telephones, so it's not utopia. And off he would go to another spot.
That's right. That was the final thing. He found a place somewhere in the South Pacific. John went all the way across the world. He was a really nice man from North Carolina. He went around Europe. He went to castles in Spain and Scotland. He went to the Isles of Greece. Spent probably $40,000 or $50,000, and not one word got in the paper, because when he finally found paradise and sent his copy over, because it was before laptops, his editor went into the publisher and said, "We found it, we've done it, here it is." And Pope read it and said, "This sounds wonderful, you know, no, there's no traffic, there's nothing like that." And then 10 minutes later, he sent his secretary out, bring the editor back in. He said, how did he get this report back to you? He said, we phoned it in. He said, there's phones on this island?
And that disqualified it as being utopia. We're talking with Paul Bannister, author of Tabloid Man. Many stories still to come, including I want to get into when we come back whether or not the publisher of the National Enquirer was a CIA operative specializing in psychological warfare. Go-Go's taking us into the break. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.